Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, military, economic, as well as media and academic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, that they simply can't be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to know who is working against our interests, to understand how and why they are doing so, because exposing and condemning such schemes isn't hateful. It's the most caring thing we can do. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore Paul's letters to the Galatians, which was his first, to pit it against Yahweh's teachings, so that we can prove conclusively that Paul was a false apostle. If you would like to participate in this discussion anytime over the next 3 hours, you're welcome to call 877-376-45. It was not my intent, but it certainly became too intriguing to pass up. To make the first topic of today what many would consider an oxymoron. As for me, I don't. The story begins, this is Fox News, and what some would see as an oxymoron. The advocacy group, apparently, this is an advocacy group called Military Association for Atheists and Freethinkers, the MAAF, the MAAF, is preparing to ask the Department of Defense to appoint chaplains for atheists. A source tells Fox News that the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers plans to pursue the request today, floating its president, Jason Torfey, as the proposed chaplain. Representative, this would be Congressman John Fleming, who is a Republican from Louisiana, last year opposed the creation of a position. He also voiced concern about the planned request. He told Fox News that he's got to wait to see how the proposal plays out, but threatened to use legislation to block it if necessary. And he's done so successfully in the past. Democrats, however, on the opposite side of the aisle, those who favor socialism and who have a natural affinity for humanism, unsuccessfully tried to pass legislation creating a post in 2013, just recently. In response, Republicans, who of course mixed their politics with their religion, offered up a measure of their own to prohibit the Pentagon from naming such a chaplain. With Congress at odds, though, the Defense Department may choose on its own. A separate organization, the Humanist Society, has endorsed Oxford-educated religious scholar Jason Heap. He was proposed last year to be the first ever humanist chaplain in the U.S. Navy. Now, I found that interesting. You know, we've had a number of discussions with Glenn, who calls the program regularly, who is well-educated on this topic, who is not fond of me referring to socialist secular humanism as a religion, noting, as he has, and he is certainly accurate in doing so, that secularism and sectarianism, which is one is non-religious and the other is religious, that blending sectarianism, secularism with religion would be an oxymoron. He's right. Those terms go together like oil and water. But nonetheless, when you see a story like this, it certainly gives credence to the idea that humanism has become a belief system in America, and that it may, in fact, be the fastest growing, in fact, I would argue it is the fastest growing belief system in the country. Well, I think it represents now about 20 or so percentage of the American people. Although I don't think they would actually identify themselves with the belief system, their lifestyles, their approach to life would suggest that they are, and that if you were to take younger Americans, those most recently influenced by academic institutions, where political correctness is professed with religious zeal, that you'd have a much higher percentage than that who would associate themselves with humanism, particularly identifying themselves with humanistic ideals. The MOF, the organization that is offering the application for the humanist chaplain, has argued that more people identify themselves as atheists and as humanists in the U.S. military than all other non-Christian denominations. The Republican lawmakers who have fought these efforts have described the push as nonsensical. The motto of the Armand Chaplain Corps is, after all, Pro Deo et Patria, for God and country. It's pretty amazing that they would declare their motto in Latin, which, of course, is the language of Rome, where Rome made exactly the same declaration. It was for gods and country. In fact, it is the Roman experience of blending politics and religion that gave birth to the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. It is this blending of patriotism and religion that has caused the world to be so vicious over these many centuries. Fleming, the Republican congressman from Louisiana, said last year that the idea of an atheist chaplain is an oxymoron. It's contradictory. What are you doing? What you're doing is now saying that we're going to have to replace true chaplains with non-chaplain chaplains. Well, the reality is that the fastest growing religion in America, one promoted in the media, by politicians, and in academia, is that of man worshiping man. Its moral code is political correctness. And today, if you step outside of the parameters of what is accepted politically in this replacement moral code, you are crucified. Your behavior can be stellar, but if your words besmirch any closely held axiom of socialist humanism, oh, you'll lose your basketball team. You will be pushed off your football team. You will be retired from the media. You will lose your job as a professor. You will be railroaded out of office politically. It does not suffer heretics well. Man-made global warming is an example of man overemphasizing the role of man. Freedom provided by military men, which is a myth, is another example. Entitlements from governments of men, as well as the adoration of men and women in prominent positions. The MAAF argues that military chaplains are not providing enough outreach for those who believe in man rather than God. According to research in 2009 by the Defense Equal Opportunity Management Institute, boy, there's an organization in need of a acronym, about a quarter of military service members who participated in the study say they held no religious preference. They didn't say they weren't religious. They just didn't prefer one religion over another. More than 4% identified themselves as humanists, while a little over 1% said they were pagans. Several organizations and religious scholars have pressed the U.S. military to consider naming chaplains for those service members. A religion for those without a religious preference among other religions. Such broad-based and growing support of professionals and experts should make it easy for the Department of Defense and the Navy to open their doors to diversity, to those whose belief systems includes humanists and non-theists. I decided that it would be interesting to look up what is said about humanism. And the first thing, happens to be from Wikipedia. I'm not claiming that Wikipedia is the most credible source, but they certainly are the most popular source of definitions and of information. Humanism, as it was conceived in the 20th century, you find written on the Wikipedia site, rejected revealed knowledge. It rejected theism-based morality, and it rejected the supernatural. In the late 20th century, the humanist movement that affirms the dignity and worth of all men came into conflict with conservative Christian groups, especially in the United States, and thereby secular humanism became the most popular name of organized humanism. Though practitioners of religious humanism did not officially organize under the name humanism until the late 19th and early 20th centuries, non-theistic religions paired with human-centric ethical philosophies date all the way back to the age of Enlightenment. They have here a number of references that are equally interesting in this integration between humanism and religious thought. First, regarding the French Revolution, which would be the Jacobins. It's interesting, and we'll attend to this after the commercial break. It's interesting that the Jacobins are the first tangible evidence of the influence of Adam Weishaupt and his Order of the Illumes, known to conspiracy buffs as the Illuminati. And their cult of reason was religious. So the first manifestation of the religious aspect of humanism came through the cult of reason. It was a religion based upon deism, devised during the French Revolution. And it is interesting for several reasons. One is that so that the Jacobins, who were the cult of reason aficionados, were the first tangible manifestation of Adam Weishaupt's new religious concept that was promoted as the order of the illuminated, of the enlightened. And Adam Weishaupt, in creating this religious movement of humanism, of really socialist humanism, was desirous in changing the order, the political order of things. He didn't like the fact that kings ruled because of their past, that the new king was the son of the old king, and that this method of controlling Europe was cemented into place by the Roman Catholic Church and, in the East, the Eastern Orthodox Church. So he wanted instead to have the most enlightened men, the best educated men. Now, he was a college professor in Germany. So he wanted to have the men that he thought were the best prepared to rule. And for that to occur, he would have to come up with a religious alternative that the masses would submit to that could be used in place of Christianity, because his sphere of influence was Europe. So he came up with what is really a communist or socialist religion, really on fascist ideas, and don't get tripped up over the fact that fascism is considered to be the antithesis of communism. It really isn't. They're both human control mechanisms for economic productivity that use absolute centralized authority over people to create the political and economic climate. The only difference is in fascism, individuals can own businesses and property, where in communism, they can simply control them. But since the control mechanisms in fascism are usually even more strict than they are in communism, the difference between the two is insignificant, other than the wealth accumulated by those that are the chosen ones, the illuminated, in Adam Weishaupt's parlance. So Adam Weishaupt recognized that for him to prevail, he was going to have to profoundly influence society and over time gradually indoctrinate people into seeing the world through his eyes. And so that's why he used first the Freemasonry and then academia, as well as religious seminaries, to promote his agenda. And the first that we see of it is the French Revolution. Now, Adam Weishaupt did most of what he wrote, most of his plan, and executed it right as America was forming, which is at the same time as essentially the French Revolution. And so those individuals that promoted it wanted to have a test case where they took power away from the church and away from this inherited rule of kings, and to see if they could put the most enlightened men in charge of the country. They met in a place named after Jacob, and they became known as the Jacobins. Thomas Jefferson, while he didn't publicly admit to it, was certainly a deist, and therefore and was very, very close to the Jacobins. Probably was a Jacobin. In 1793, this article reads, during the French Revolution, the Cathedral Notre Dame de Paris was turned into a temple of reason. And for a time, Lady Liberty replaced the Virgin Mary on several altars. Isn't that interesting? Lady Liberty in the Temple of Reason and Notre Dame de Paris was the altar, replacement deity for socialist secular humanism. In the 1850s, I should say, positivism reigned supreme. And the father of sociology founded positivism as a religion of humanity. And by the way, I can't pronounce it very well. We ought not snicker at that, because that is really the nature of religion and politics today. Hope. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So positivism, which would be the religious philosophy of being optimistic, is a overwhelming doctrine in today's world. It is pervasive, particularly in politics, where providing hope is typically the difference between those who prevail and those who do not. Even if the hope is completely misguided, even if there is really no hope, even if what the person is doing is just a continuation of what their predecessors have done, hope we can believe in is the mother's milk of politics. And it is also the basis of standard religions, particularly in Christianity, where hope that those who have passed away will be in heaven, where there is hope of salvation based upon what one believes. They're false hopes. But hope is what drives both patriotism, it drives economic activity, it drives political ambitions. We have Glenn on the line, who I'm sure has insights regarding the development of humanism as a quasi-religious doctrine. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, Yada. I can hear the refrain echoing down through history, "You shall be of God, knowing good and evil." You know, humanism. You know, I'll be the judge of that.
Boy, hey, by the way, that is an extraordinarily profound insight. We get right to the beginning of the lure of the adversary, suggesting that we can be just like the gods, and we've built entire empires on that notion. Right now in the middle of editing the mini series I've written on the wars of the Roman Empire, and the stage I'm at right now has Julius Caesar attempting to manifest himself as God, and how the Roman Empire emperors after him literally created statues of themselves in shrines made to honor themselves so that they would be worshipped as if they were gods.
Yes, when you talk about Jefferson, I'm looking at a picture of Thomas Jefferson's memorial, you know, his statue, mm-hmm. and sitting in a very Romanesque domed cathedral,
yes.
while Lincoln sits in a Greek square cathedral.
The Lincoln Memorial is a temple.
Yes,
it's called a temple. Right. I mean, if you look it up, it is a temple. We have built temples and memorials and shrines to men in America. I mean, look at the Washington Memorial. The Washington Memorial is the most acclaimed historic edifice to sun gods, particularly in Egypt.
Right. And actually, well, when you were on yesterday, I had already left the call, but there was a news blurb on yesterday about the reopening of the Washington Monument, which I mentioned last week. But mentioned that the benefactor was apparently a fellow named, I think it was Rubenstein or something like that. It was not your typical Freemasonic name. You know, it's like, why would a wealthy Jewish man want to fund a pagan Babylonian solar phallic symbol? But
you also mentioned Freemasonry, which Freemasonry has never been kind to Jews. That's why the reward for becoming the highest level Freemason is to become a Shriner. And when you become a Shriner, everything about Shriners is Islamic. And of course, all you have to do is read the Quran to know the love and affinity that Muslims have for Jews. So yes, why would a Jewish individual fund a phallic symbol to sun gods that was built and dedicated in Freemasonry custom?
Right, and as you go up in the elevator, watching your mind, you can see all the various slabs of the stones, and you know. With a various Freemasonic insignia and stuff like that at various levels as you go up. And they sell the Freemasonic book about the history, like, right there in the bookshop. So
they
keep it on. But, the Lincoln Memorial is angular,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you make angles with squares, and the Jefferson Memorial is Roman curvaceous, which, like, curves with a compass.
Which is Freemasonry, and both of them form that the triangle of Freemasonry with the Washington Memorial. So it's all of Washington is really set out to celebrate Freemasonry, which Christians all too often associate with Christianity, and therefore talk about being a Christian nation. But this nation was founded by Jacobin and a bunch of Freemasons.
I have battled. There's a Christian talk show host who I have, politely argued with about that. And it's like, you know, even if you could prove that the Negro Men of America's Christian nation, what's the point? What's this? There's actually nothing to be gained from trying to make the point that America is or was a Christian nation. Italy is a Christian nation. It has a state religion. Britain's yes. a Christian nation. Germany's a Christian nation with two-state religion. What good does it do them? You know, what is the point of trying? Even if somebody conceded the point, so what? It produces
yeah.
no.
Yeah, of course. One of the interesting, if being a Christian nation was considered a good thing, and you received, from their perspective, God's blessing by being a Christian nation, then when Rome under Constantine officially adopted Christianity as the state religion. Actually, it occurs right after Constantine that it was officially adopted. But if you look at the history of Rome from that point forward, it was a series of a half a step forward and 49 step backward. I mean, it was devastating. You look at the caliber of the emperors. You look at the treatment of their neighbors. You look at the decadence that grew inside of the country. Rome as a Christian country was even more despicable than Rome was as an empire.
Oh, yeah. And then the Vatican as a civil power, I believe it was a French king that deposed the Vatican from civil power, which kind of began to turn Europe more towards sanity, but I forget what year that was. But anyway, it's just a mess.
Well, if you look at even the rise of the Vatican, of the papal power, the earliest popes had seances inside of the Vatican. They ran brothels inside of the Vatican. Rather than being elected by the influence of the Holy Ghost, as they say, you earned the right to be to play king to God by how much you were willing to pay. And it was all about bribery. Being a Christian nation is not a synonymous with being good. It is actually more prone to being synonymous with being evil and corrupt.
Right, exactly. But as what you were saying earlier about humanism, I think more and more people are catching on. Also, as you talked about socialism, socialism is technically an economic system.
Right.
Communism is a political system that utilizes socialist economics. A lot of people don't get that. They think socialism is communism light, but it's not.
Yeah. Well,
to a large degree,
though, fascism, communism, socialism are also mindsets. They embrace typically and almost universally embrace certain doctrines that cause them to be more than just various political or economic in their nature. But socialism is the idea of socializing the means of production, where communism is defined as the centralization, if you will, the communal nature of politics. But in reality, both of those two come with literally with religious and political baggage, as well as the economic influences. One of the things that always bothers me the most about them, of course, is that capitalism is always positioned against communism, when in fact communism, like fascism, is a capitalistic economic a system. All systems are capitalistic. Capital comes in a variety of different forms. People are considered a capital good. Property is a capital good. Money is a capital good. And they're all deployed in different ways, organized in different ways under those economic systems. And so if you wanted to make a distinction, it's really free enterprise versus socialism would be the proper distinction.
Well, with fascism or communism, you always end up with a totalitarian oligarchy, no matter how you slice it, whether it's the government that supposedly has the power or the businesses.
What's interesting, too, is if you look at history with the Republic of Rome and with the democracy of Greece, that both systems were elitist oligarchies. The vast preponderance of the people could not vote. Rome had a caste system that was far more strict than is the caste system that exists in India. And so Rome was not a republic in the sense of the people legislated. They were represented because, no, there was a, the only people that were represented in the Roman Republic were the aristocracy. And of course, in the democracies of Greece and Sparta, the only people who had a say were wealthy landowners.
Mm-hmm, right. And that's, and things started out that way here to some degree. But,
they did.
You used to have to be a landowner to vote here originally.
Too. Yes, correct. You had to be a male landowner to vote in America. There is, by the way, reason that man gravitates to that position. If those who are net beneficiaries of a political system can vote themselves a raise by taking money away from the few who are enriched, that you will always move towards anarchy. And so it was decided that the best form of government was, even in those areas where there was some tendency to vote, was that only those who had a vested interest, those who were making a net contribution to the country, should decide how the country's finances were spent. It's not a system that the world is considering going back to, but there is a country today where that system does prevail to a large degree, even though all Russians vote and there's genuinely is a representative government. The only ones who get to run for office are oligarchs. We'll be back with Glenn in Shattering Myths after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths as we consider the onward march and influence of humanism. We find that in the 1850s, Auguste Comte, who was the father of sociology, founded positivism as the religion of humanity. And it just as an interesting aside, as he was developing his thesis, he was a student and the secretary for the father of French socialism. So he created a religion based on altruism whereby hope became the mantra. And just think of the influence today. I mean, from hope we can believe in to the hope that is promoted from the Christian pulpit to the hope of almost every politician, it's always, yeah, we recognize that things aren't great today, but there's hope. And that's why I began this program, by taking the exact opposite view in terms of human institutions. Those who hope to change Congress so that it is no longer destructive. Those who hope to change the occupant of the White House so he or she is no longer counterproductive. Those who hope to change the culture in various places, they're misguided. It's false hope. There is no one that you can exchange for one politician or one general or one person in the media or even for hundreds of them that's going to make any difference. It's an absolute waste of time. It is false hope. But yet, for the vast preponderance of people, the overwhelming preponderance of people, at least I would say until 10 or 20 years ago, if someone like myself said that if you examine the condition and the history of government, of politicians, of academia and universities, of the media, if you consider the history of religion and its present state, that there is absolutely no chance whatsoever that any of these institutions can be resolved. And then a person debating that position said that, there's always hope. And they talk about whatever their hopeful scheme is. With the vast preponderance of those listening, the person who is promoting without evidence or reason hope would prevail with the audience. Now, we have reached a time where the hopeful no longer see hope. They recognize there's no reason to vote. It's why cast a vote for the lesser of two evils, even if that lesser of two evils could be identified. I mean, imagine the election between John McClown of Arizona, and Barack Hussein Obama. Where was the, who was the lesser of those two evils? So a vast number of people, as we learned last week, are leaving Roman Catholicism, for example, because they recognize there's no hope there. And so that doesn't mean that those individuals are hopeless. It just means that they recognize that human institutions aren't going to resolve the calamity that these institutions have brought on people. What's your impression of that? Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
It's just very problematic. I wanted to harken back to a Weishaupt for a minute, because you were talking about his opposition to intergenerational dynastic power, with the kings and stuff.
Yes.
And it's interesting. That reverses something that's more of a meritocracy, let's say. That is precisely the conflict between the Shiites and the Sunnis. The Shiites are dynastic in the sense of wanting the head of Islam to be a descendant of Muhammad, whereas the Sunnis would be more like Weishaupt. They're saying, something for a meritocracy of some sort.
Yes, it's of course interesting that the Shiites haven't figured out that there are no descendants of Muhammad.
Exactly.
So the basis of their approach is impossible, and of course in the with the caliphate falling to the ablest man, what the Sunnis really wanted is a member of the Quraysh tribe to hold office, and of course that meant that Abu Bakr would be first, because Abu Bakr had earned his place by sacrificing his 6-year-old daughter to Muhammad's lusts. But then after him, they would propose, and did propose, the ablest and most fierce Islamic warriors. And so the Sunni experience was to model Muhammad's behavior, while the Shiite was to model his genitals, I guess. Neither turned out very well.